Hi, this is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the second week of August, and it is a very special live Tribcast, but I just wanted to tell you ahead of time that in the middle of it, the lights on the stage started to change color rapidly and dramatically, and it was very distracting. So keep that in mind when you hear the spontaneous laughter and confusion that ensued. Enjoy. Hello. Thank you for coming, everyone. If any of you have ever listened to the Tribcast before, and I don't know
both
how many
of you
that is.
That are out there.
You know, we always have a celebrity intro to kick us off, but this very special live Tribcast night, we have three potential intros, so we're going to play all three of them for you, and then we'll have you vote on which one you think would be the best one. So I'm going to start, and then I think Ross will play you the second one, and then Evan will play. This is a bit of technology gimmick that we have not tried at all, so we'll see. All right, here we go.
It's going really well so far.
This is Rick Perry, and my good friend Chuck Norris recently told me his favorite podcast in the world is the Texas Tribune Tribcast. That's actually not true. I just wanted an excuse to point out I'm good friends with Chuck Norris. Ladies and gentlemen, it's this week's Tribcast.
All right, that's option one.
Option number one.
This is Rick Perry. People in Texas are in desperate need of fair, unbiased, and intelligent analysis of politics in the Lone Star State. Until that happens, they'll have to settle for the Texas Tribune Tribcast. And now, here's the
number two.
All right,
that's two. All right, and here's number three.
This is Rick Perry. And over the past 10 years, Texas employers have created 1.2 million new jobs. After listening to this show, maybe we could have done without four of them. Ladies and gentlemen, it's this week's Texas Tribune Tribcast.
What I wanted him to say was, I've got three favorite Texas Tribune Tribcasts, but I can't remember the third. That would have actually been, that would have been great.
Well,
we didn't
I think
get to write the script, though.
He learned on his campaign trail that maybe he has a career in comedy. So that's where he's starting here.
Unintentionally funny, that's right.
Do you guys have a preferred one that we should use?
All right, well, hold on. Maybe you should...
Sounds like number one. That's my favorite.
All right, so here, let's
the fix was in all along.
Let's do applause for number... It sounds like one's out, so let's do applause for number two. If this is 50-50, I don't know what the hell we're going to do. All right, let's do applause for number three. Sounds like two.
Definitely number
Unless
two.
Unless there was rampant voter fraud that we just heard, I think it's probably, people voting twice, I think it's probably number two.
How many of you are actually dead? We're just wondering.
All right.
If the media was covering this election, you know, it would be down to the wire, I think. We'd still be undecided. But it's a two win, so that's the one we'll use. So we're going to start off by, our last Tribcast was recorded immediately after the July 31st runoff. And now we have about a week or so that we have had more time to process. And I think everyone's had more time to process. Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, who, once again, if you don't know and don't listen to the Tribcast, he actually lost the runoff and will not be the next U.S. Senator from Texas. He has since said that he would do some things differently in his campaign if he had the
chance
to.
Like when?
But he... Yeah, but he didn't say what specifically because he said that would give away his strategy for next time. So what do you think he learned on the campaign trail that he probably will do differently?
Spend somebody else's money.
You know, he financed his own campaign, and it took a long time because the primary got delayed, and that gave everybody else time to get traction. And it sounded like the Dewhurst campaign was one of those campaigns where they had so much money that they didn't have to make any decisions. You know, if you're short of money, you say we can either go right or left, but we can't afford both. And they didn't have to really think about everything. They kind of threw in everything but the kitchen sink, and it got very confusing and very muddled very quickly and stayed that way for a long, long time.
I'm not sure that any amount of money could have saved David Dewhurst in this race. And I think there were three reasons why that is the case. And the first really is that external forces affected this race, had nothing to do with Cruz, had nothing to do with Dewhurst. The Indiana Senate race and the Nebraska Senate race set the narrative up coming into Texas. And Ted Cruz was the third stone in the path. I think anybody with plausible Tea Party credibility would have probably benefited from what happened in Indiana and Nebraska, and that was Dewhurst's biggest problem. He wasn't that guy. He was running against that guy, but he wasn't that guy. Second problem is he was an extraordinarily bad candidate. He just was. And the campaign around him was terrible itself, but you can't do much with a bad candidate, and he just ran a bad campaign.
Yeah, I think he used television commercials as a proxy for actually going out and meeting people, which is the exact opposite of what Ted Cruz did. He spent the 18 months leading up to the runoff visiting every single Republican group in the state, every women's group, every county party group. He just traveled around the state meeting all of them, and each time he was able to point to the blank chair at the table with him and say, you see who's not here? It's Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst, so I'm going to call him a tax-raising, big-spending liberal, and he can't defend himself.
Well, he's not here to defend himself, and I think you've illustrated what is the largest problem for Dewhurst in the way this campaign was run. Going into the race, his biggest problem was that the Tea Party did not consider him one of theirs. Now, they're probably right. But they viewed him as not one of theirs, and he needed to get across that line with them because he wasn't going to win the race without them. And yet his campaign kept him from attending something like three dozen or more Tea Party forums more, at which he could have at least made his case. Instead, as Ben says, he was left to have Ted Cruz attack him and no ability to defend himself before a group that was going to decide the outcome of the race, didn't trust him going in, and came to trust him less during the course of the campaign.
But could you be overreading the Tea Party element of it? If you go down the ballot, how do you account for, like, Roger Williams trouncing Wes Riddle, who was the anointed guy?
What was interesting, there wasn't really an ideological difference between the two candidates, or at least not one that they could explain. So in one of the debates, we asked them what would be the difference between Senator Cruz and Senator Dewhurst, and they didn't really have an answer. There was kind of an answer, and it's a great line. It's just they didn't intend it to be funny. One of them wants a fence on the whole border, and one of them just wants part of it to be fenced. And that's all they could come up with. What they did come up with was a massive difference in style. Cruz was much more energetic. Cruz looked like he was enjoying the fight and there to talk to people. Dewhurst looked like the whole thing was a distasteful exercise that he didn't want to play in. And voters read him as unresponsive and not paying any attention to him. One of the other things in that debate was you could tell kind of how they were approaching this race, because when they came into the room, you know, you have that awkward moment where they'd been calling each other names and they have to shake hands. And
it's Cruz, a lot like this.
Right, yeah. Yeah, a lot like this. I'm not going to shake your hand, though. And Cruz walks in and, you know, walks into the thing, and Dewhurst got as far away as he could and still shake hands. It was just, he just didn't look like he wanted to be there. And I think voters read that.
But you've made an interesting point, I think, about the what we face politically in this state. We've come to accept it as the standard deal or the status quo, but it is remarkable. Dewhurst hasn't really had competition. Right. He's run statewide four times. He's won four times. He's not practiced at running a competitive race.
He had two good races, but they were some time ago.
Right, they were a long time ago. And anyway, right. He doesn't really debate. He doesn't really have to get out and press the flesh. It's assumed that if you have an R next to your name these days in Texas, going back to 1994, no Democrats won statewide. This is what Rick Perry encountered. When Rick Perry went out on the campaign trail to run for president, he was completely out of practice. He hadn't had a competitive race, maybe really ever, but certainly since, you know, 98, right?
Yeah, maybe.
And he looked terrible because he had no practice at being better than that. And I think Dewhurst encountered a little bit of the same thing. So chalk that up at least to what redistricting has done to this state and partisanship has done to this state, that you run races and you assume you're the greatest because you always win until you run into a competitive race and you suddenly fall on your face.
And I think that's where Ted Cruz hitting all those Republican parties really was a brilliant move on his part, because we can say Dewhurst should have been at some of those, but I don't know that he's the kind of candidate that could have been at some of those. You know, I don't know if he could have.
You don't think he could have pulled it off?
I don't. I mean, well, but we'll never know. But no, I guess I don't.
Stepping away from Cruz for a second, surely there are some competitive races in the state.
Barely.
Still
barely.
Faces.
I mean,
we have a November election coming up.
I made
notes. He's got a piece of paper, folks.
It's a short list.
It's a short list. There's two statewide races that are, well, wrong list. There's one competitive congressional race out of 36. There's two competitive.
Is that Gallego?
The Gallego Canseco race.
In San Antonio.
The Weber Lampson race could be competitive. The district votes Republican, but it's an open seat, so maybe.
If you want to know who those people are, Google them.
Yeah, we'll have a big, giant, mega spreadsheet up on the website in a minute. The State Board of Education, two races out of 15. The State Senate, one race out of 31. The State House with 150 seats. 98 members of the House don't have major party opposition, including 34 Democrats and 64 Republicans. So congratulations, you may already be a winner. And of the remaining races, 12 or 13 are still competitive. So there's not really a lot on the ballot. You pretty much know what you're going to get.
And now, that may be, that 12 or 13 may ultimately be an exaggeration. And it's possible that other races will become competitive even though they're not competitive now because something will happen. But the fact is, redistricting has essentially taken away your choice and everyone's choice in the vast majority of the state.
My goodness, we've changed
the
name
from the
queue.
It must have gotten the end of a tunnel.
There's the green light.
Correct.
If it goes red, you're wrong.
Right.
I think we're... Well.
For those of you listening, just adjust your lighting.
We got a strobe light effect going on here. Well, I forget what I was going to say.
Ordinarily, that's the case without the lighting.
You know, now I am shocked, though, that there's not a competitive race statewide. I'm sure I saw several Democratic pundits praying that Ted Cruz would get the nomination because they say he's too far right.
You know,
please explain, Ross Ramsey.
Eventually, it's going to be competitive, but no Democrat's broken 44% for a long time in Texas. They just haven't done it. And then, you know, it's one of those things where eventually the Republicans came back and broke the two-party Democratic state, but it took ages, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen this year.
And, you know, Paul Sadler's a nice guy. Paul Sadler's a good Democrat.
Are we going to debate this now?
I don't think we have to debate it. I think we can acknowledge that Paul Sadler, good Democrat, former state lawmaker. Okay. That feels like Spinal Tap up here. Where's the 18-inch Stonehenge? Come on.
Cast rave.
Wait a minute. Which one's the drummer? I wonder. Apparently me.
All I know is before KUT took over the Cactus Cafe, the lights worked fine. too soon, you think? I do think Sadler is in the unfortunate position of being the guy who's being sent up the river here in a state in which no Democrats won in years. He's a good guy. He's former chair of public education, right. Five-time best legislator on Texas Monthly's list. He's a real guy.
I would like to see. But, I mean, whether it's competitive, you know, or not, I do want to see this debate because it's two smart guys.
Cruz has agreed to debate, so I think we will see at least one debate.
I think the debates between these two guys, you know, if you're a political nerd like the rest of us, could be really, really great.
So, but barring a miracle, we expect Cruz to be the next U.S. senator.
Yeah, it'll be it. It would be a huge story if it went the other way. Give a radio station a light switch.
And he's already moved on to sort of the national conversation,
right?
Can we talk about sort of what has happened to Ted Cruz in the last week? He has become the golden child of the Romney campaign, it seems.
Of Republicans in kind general, of, nationally.
He's in like 4 out of 5 of their last press releases. You know, they send these, you know, they've got national press lists, and Cruz is sort of the flavor of the week. I don't know, I guess they're having some primaries today, and we may replace him, but for right now, he's the guy they're putting on Fox News Sunday. He's the guy they're using to, you know, to show the kind of the energetic wing of the Republican Party.
And the blogs are more concerned about whether or not he'll speak at the RNC now than they are Sarah Palin.
Well, I think they'll give him a big speech, right?
They've got a problem here in that Romney, you know, is more like Dewhurst than like Cruz. So you can't put them too close together, you know. Wait, I think I saw that already. But
right, but I think it's interesting that right away Cruz has fully embraced Romney as the candidate for president, more because he happens to be the not Obama candidate than anything else. Right. But where some of the Cruz supporters are making a face at this is, well, a lot of what Romney says is the kind of stuff that we campaigned against when Dewhurst said it. And so why are you suddenly embracing and endorsing Romney? It's because you've gone from being the insurgent Senate candidate to being the senator-elect, which puts you squarely in the establishment no matter what you want to say about yourself. Cruz, like Rand Paul and all the others before him, is now part of the thing that he campaigned against. Right. And so it's not entirely surprising that he embraces Romney.
And so is that enough to put Romney over the top?
In Texas?
He was going to win Texas anyway.
Yeah, he'll probably win Texas.
Yeah. I didn't say in Texas. I mean nationally. What do you guys think is going to happen?
Let me raise one thing about Cruz, which I think we don't have an answer to, but is going to be an interesting question to be litigated over the next little while. You know, Cruz is Hispanic, but Cruz, his roots are Cuban, not Mexican. And I think an interesting conversation will be, is there a difference from a values standpoint and then from a political standpoint in Cuban Hispanics as opposed to Mexican Hispanics, because people, I think, mistakenly lump all Hispanics together monolithically. But we've known for years that the Cubans in Miami and the Mexicans in Texas and the Puerto Ricans in New York don't necessarily see the world the same way, just because they all happen to have, they happen to be, quote, Latino. And so the question is, will the Mexican Americans in Texas view Cruz, who has Cuban roots, as necessarily sharing 100% their values? And is the idea that somehow Cruz now is going to solve the Republican Party's problem with Latinos maybe a little bit too facile a statement?
Well, and that's, I saw a tweet the night of the election saying, can we finally put to bed the idea that a Hispanic cannot win a primary in Texas because Cruz is one? And of course, an immediate response was, ask Justice Medina about that.
Right. On the exact same night.
On the exact same night, Supreme Court Justice
Walsh. I think you can put that to bed. Medina had a million problems. You know, he'd been charged with arson.
But a Hispanic name, you know, was not one.
You know, there were, you know, there were some other issues there. And Cruz won, and Villalba won in Dallas. And, you know, they had a good night. I don't think that that's really, you know, so much a question anymore. And the candidates who lost didn't raise it. You know, Medina, unlike Victor Carrillo before him, didn't say, this is why I lost. He just disappeared.
Huh. Just like the Tribcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was actually hoping you would just segue into the national election, since I know you want to talk about it. But now I'll just let you do that naturally. Unnaturally.
Well, I think it's a natural conversation, because as Cruz is supporting Romney, the question of, is the Tea Party sufficiently enthusiastic about Romney as a candidate is obviously always part of the conversation about the fall. This is an election that in which we're treated to all these national polls, and the election appears to be so close. I'm always interested in the fact that this is not a national election. It's 50 state elections. If it were a national election, Gore would have been president in 2000. It's not a national election. Well, nothing to clap about. It's a fact. Gore would have been president if it were a national election, but it isn't. It's not an election decided by popular vote. It's an election decided by electoral votes. And if you look at the 50 state polls, and if you look at the electoral votes, Michael Tomasky in the Daily Beast pointed this out, I thought, pretty well this week. This is not a close election, at least as far as the electoral votes go now. Contrary to the popular vote, Obama's killing Romney. And contrary to the popular vote, the route for Romney to win this election is extremely narrow.
He would have to flip not just all the toss-up states, but also the states that are leaning Obama.
Well, at least,
a couple of them.
Well, I mean, that's the assumption. And the assumption on the Republican side is that, you know, if you look at the economy in those states and you look at the attachment of Obama to blame for that economy, then, you know, maybe you can flip some of those states and it's not as daunting as it looks on paper.
The idea that there was a poll out today, there was a poll out today that had Obama up in North Carolina in mid-August of 2012 tells me that we don't really have any idea. We're making assumptions about certain states. Well, you can write off Indiana. Well, you can write off North Carolina. Well, the president's going to have a hard time holding maybe Virginia or maybe Florida. But the president's got a 45-point lead versus Romney among the Hispanic community. With those numbers, if those are believable...
The Hispanic community from which country?
Well, the Cubans and the Mexicans and the Puerto Ricans. How about that? And the Spaniards and holding. But I think if you look at Colorado, New Mexico, and Nevada, which are, you know, if not largely, then even majority Hispanic, it's very hard to imagine how, if Romney is that far behind in the Latino community against Obama, that he has a chance in those states.
Now that Obama's the NASCAR president, right?
And that he has Mayor Castro of San Antonio, very conspicuously, is the keynote speaker at the convention. The president is working hard to get the Latino vote. I just look at the map and I go, without really a point of view about how it should be resolved, somebody who is for Romney and looks at the electoral map and is not living in a fantasy land, tell me the route there. No one has been able to do that.
Is it possible that our old models could just be wrong and we're measuring this thing wrong, sort of a la Mike Baselice and the Dewhurst poll? Baselice obviously is like one of the great pollsters.
Yeah,
he's
a great pollster. He's got a long record, and he put out a poll, or the campaign put out a poll, which he says was part but not all of his data, that said
that was way off.
Dewhurst was beating Cruz on Sunday, but hadn't reached 50%. Monday must have been a very bad day, I guess.
Tuesday was definitely a bad day.
You know, 48 hours later, he was 14 points behind. So, you know, yeah, your assumptions can always be wrong. You know, it's particularly one of the things that happened in the Texas election was there are almost 19 million voting age adults in Texas, and 1.1 million voted in the Republican primary. So it took you 551,000 votes, give or take, to beat David Dewhurst, or to win that primary. So that small number of people can win an election. And if you've got a small number of people like that, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to be representative of the center of the state. It doesn't have.
The question is how energized every community in every state is to turn out for this election. And it seems like people on both sides are energized. And if the numbers are similar to what they were in 2008, if you look at the map, I'm trying to understand where this ends up, and I can't see how it's not reasonably conclusive right now. Things will change potentially, but I'd like to hear the counter case.
All right, well, and since that race and almost all the other races in Texas sound like they're wrapped up.
Yeah, we're done.
Perhaps it's time to start looking to the legislative session. And I think the big talk in the legislature at the moment is, of course, the Texas Tribune and their massive asks for tax returns. And Evan, do you have any thoughts on why we are asking for tax returns?
Well, we're asking for tax returns because the personal financial disclosure forms filed by elected officials with the Texas Ethics Commission are woefully inadequate. We're not getting enough of a level of transparency from elected officials so that we can see whether their personal financial interests are in conflict with the business they do for us.
I don't understand why you want their children to be kidnapped.
Because we're all bad people, is what it is.
That was the argument before the Texas Ethics Commission when they're writing the sunset bill that'll be voted on in the next legislative session, and somebody tried to put in an amendment that made it easier, and you could find the disclosure forms online, and somebody said, well, people would kidnap the legislature's children.
And then I think, following that statement, I think we went on sort of an extended rant on the Tribcast about kidnapping the legislators' children, which we really shouldn't go down again, and we apologize for.
I'm sure you all heard that podcast anyway, so.
Those documents are all online, by the way, at the Texas Tribune instead of at the state of Texas, right? So, but the problem with those things is that you can fulfill all of the requirements of those financial disclosures that the state asked for and not really tell anybody anything. And then you come out, you know, as David Dewhurst has. He's filed those things for years. He finally runs for the U.S. Senate. They have much more stringent filing requirements because of the politics of the time. He also threw in some tax returns. And you get a completely different view of what his financial situation is. And that part's interesting. But what's really important here is that, you know on an individual lawmaker level, are they voting on things that affect their business? Are they voting on things that benefit them? You can tell the good guys from the bad guys.
But you also get information on their spouses and, you know, is there something to be said for letting people have a private life?
Sure. But, you know, there's something to be said for, you know, knowing, you know, you got to count the silver when your public servants leave the room, you know. So you should be able to judge whether what they did was proper.
You if they wanted privacy, don't run for office. Stay in the public.
You can't tell right now whether somebody's doing something in his or her own interest or whether they're doing it in the public interest. And you should be able to tell that.
And is this any different from calling for Romney's tax returns? Do his tax returns matter more because he's running for president, or is state rep the same thing?
It's the same issue. I mean, it's probably, you know, weightier when you're at the White House.
Well, we try to avoid weighty.
I think the difference is that in Romney's case, people want to understand how'd you make your money. You have offshore bank accounts, it's alleged. Let's talk about your holdings, and let's talk about where that money is and why. Let's understand better who you are and how you made your money and all that going forward. I think in the case of state legislators, we're not looking to mess with people's spouses. On the other hand, if I'm an elected official, if I'm a state representative, and I vote on a piece of legislation that ultimately benefits the industry or the specific business of my spouse, that is a germane fact that the public that votes for that elected official has a right to know, in my view.
And
transparency trumps pretty much everything else from an accountability standpoint. And if the elected officials of this state are not prepared to turn over their tax returns so that we can see whether those conflicts, potential or real, exist, I think that's a disservice in the public interest of the people.
And it's something that the current energized base that votes, mostly Tea Party, wants and has yelled for. And
maybe the one
where the left and the right agree.
This came up in a bipartisan issue.
This came up in an election a couple of years ago. So Kim Brimer was a state senator. He got a Texas Ethics Commission ruling that said it is illegal in the state of Texas to use campaign funds to buy real estate, like to buy a house in Austin to live in while you're here legislating. But it is legal if you sign a certain kind of an agreement with your spouse for her to buy a property and for you to rent it from her with campaign funds. So that was legal, but it wasn't great politics, as he found out when he ran against Wendy Davis. So, you know, you ought to be able to know those
kinds
of things.
That's Ken Reimer, the former state senator.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And,
yeah.
what you all should know about this is that the two elected officials who have first stepped forward and said, we believe that transparency is an important thing, and despite our own personal reservations about this, our own desire not to have our personal business exposed for the world to see, we think that there's value in providing these tax returns. Donna Howard and Elliot Neistat of Austin were the first two to step forward and say that they intended to release their tax returns. We will see if others follow suit. It's a tough issue, and I appreciate the fact that some legislators feel like they're being put in a box by us and that they're going to be made to look bad for perfectly reasonable reasons if they don't do it. But we're going to continue to press our case.
Charlie Guerin, not of Austin, has done the opposite.
He's the administration chairman of the Texas House, and right. His response to the request was to send a memo to the rest of the House that said, you don't have to, under law, give your personal income tax returns to the Texas Tribune, and I'm not going to do it. Well, so you do whatever you want.
And if you would like to send any memos to the Tribcast.
Don't send your tax returns.
Yeah, please. We don't care about your tax returns. Unless you're an elected official.
Yeah, anyone out there?
Well, I don't know. Neistat came to the last one of these. Tribcast@texastribune.org is the email. I guess I will officially wrap this up, and then we'll just open it up for a few minutes of questions. So on behalf of Ross, Evan, Ben, and myself, thanks for coming. Thanks for listening. Thanks for doing the lights. we'll hear you next week. All right, and now it's question time. I was wondering why we chose this color to settle on.
You look good in this color. Yeah. I don't know.
It's easy to white balance. Not really at all. But. Okay, we have quite a few questions, so we'll just go around.
Yes, I was wondering, as I understand it, the next group of legislators are going to be pretty much newbies. I assume this is going to affect what's going to be able to be passed and how effective it's going to be. Do you have anything to say about this issue?
You remember the first thing you told the freshmen in high school was, you know, to go try to find the swimming pool in a high school where there wasn't one. They're going to wander around for 4 weeks not knowing really what's going on. Right now the numbers are 40 members of the House are not coming back.
Paso.
You know, 40 members of the House. It's a 150-member House. 40 members are going to be freshmen on top of the 30 or 35 freshmen from last time. 5 senators of 31, which is a lot in the Senate. There's not much turnover over there. There are a lot of freshmen around. The thing that I think is really going to change this is that the people getting elected both in Democratic primaries right now and in Republican primaries, certainly right now, are more conservative on average than the people they're replacing. And they're coming in with all of the things that you've been hearing over the last 18 months in politics, fresh in their mind. And, you know, politicians are responsive, and they're going to come in doing what it is that they think the voters have been telling them. So it could be a markedly more conservative legislature.
And it's not just that half the House will be freshmen or sophomores. It's that you've lost in this transition from the last session to this one, the chairman of the Senate Public Education Committee, the chairman of the House Public Education Committee, the vice chairman of the House Public Education Committee, the commissioner of education, the commissioner of health and human services, chairman of finance in the Senate, chairman of corrections, chairman of chairman of judiciary in the House. You have got something like 6 or 7 or maybe even 8 key chairmen in the House, a couple of key chairmen in the Senate, key vice chairman in the House. It isn't just that anybody left. It's people who had a lot of experience managing what are the biggest issues before us right now. We are almost certain to have an experience shortfall to go with the budget shortfall in the next session. Not good.
One other question right back here.
Given the states that are, the voter registration laws are being challenged, what will happen in terms of the voting capability for those people that can't vote? How will that affect the election?
It doesn't look like the state's new voter ID laws, I assume that's what you're asking about, are going to be allowed to be in effect for this election. They're hung up in court and DOJ, and
What about the rest of the country? I don't know about the rest of the country.
No shame in saying you don't know. Yeah. We don't know.
Well, the theory is that there's going to be an effort to suppress the vote in places. I mean, again, this is the Democrats will say, In fact, a prominent Democrat said to me yesterday, we believe that there's going to be a concerted effort to suppress the vote in places like Cleveland and Philadelphia and in Denver, in states where they assume the president has an advantage and there's a hope that a suppressed turnout will ultimately make those states closer or possibly flip them to Republicans. That could be a conspiracy theory. It could be true. It could be someplace in between those two. There's no question that the laws on the books married to the informal efforts to keep the vote down, which frankly are both parties. I mean, it's not as if no one is blameless in this effort. Politics is not easy and friendly all the time. But there's no question that there's going to be an effort to keep the vote down in key places. Again?
Will it affect the election?
It could. I mean, if this election is closer than the map suggests now, and if it comes down to Ohio, and there's an effort to... Remember, George Bush only became president for a second term because 60,000 people in Ohio more did not vote for John Kerry. 2004 was an enormously close election. If this is an election like that, could voter suppression efforts in a place like Ohio or somewhere else turn out to be the difference? Yes. Definitely.
Right here is the question.
On the national front, it's the economic debate seems to be shaping up between a fairly classical Keynesian Democrat and a private equity banker representing the free capitalism side. America doesn't seem to know which direction it wants to go. What would have to happen in the next 80-some-odd days for us to know that there's some sort of mandate, some sort of direction that the country wants to take as far as fixing the economy?
I think that both campaigns would have to stop spinning and lying to the people and actually put out policy initiatives. I mean, you've got on the Republican side, Mitt Romney, making hay out of a statement that he is not using the right way, with Obama saying that, you know, you didn't build this, meaning you didn't build the roads that are in front of your business, not you didn't build the small business. And that at the moment is the big selling point. On the Democratic side, you have Senator Reid saying that he's positive Mitt Romney is hiding money, you know, on Mars, and that's why the curiosity is up there. Actually, he's looking for it. So I think if we want the American people to try to come up with, if we want the American people to decide among themselves what path we should go on, both candidates should actually present a path and not talking points about why the other person is going to drag us down to hell.
Which is a path.
That's true.
In publicizing this evening, KUT said, or someone said, that you guys were going to talk about what would happen if Obama got reelected. And what would happen if Mitt Romney got elected?
You can't
talk
about that right now.
You have not approached that.
You cannot believe everything John Ailey says. I'm just going to say that right now. I'm not.
But I am really curious as to what you guys, who are probably smarter than any of us sitting here.
Not true, but I'll take a stab at that if you want, and see if anybody else wants to jump in on this. I think that regardless of whether Obama or Romney wins the election, the House of Representatives is going to remain Republican, and the Senate is going to be essentially 50-50, you know, one vote on either side. You're going to have a divided Congress. The Republican margin in the House may be a little bit less. It's not going to be significantly more in the worst case for Democrats. So if the president wins re-election, he's going to have a Republican Congress. And he's going to have to make a decision to either fight them for the next few years or figure out a way to try to get them to come to the table. Hasn't worked so far. I think both sides have probably not been as sincere about trying to work with the other side. In an election year, you can't expect anything better than that. If Romney wins, Romney's likely going to win, and that in turn will ensure that both the House and I suspect the Senate are Republican. If Romney wins, it's probably going to carry a couple of the marginal Republican senators over the line. And I think we will have litigated this question of, do you want to grow the economy by making people pay their fair share, as the president says, or do you want to grow the economy by going back to the old trickle-down economics, which some people think was great and some people don't. So if Romney wins, I think it's going to be back to the future.
Well, two things. If Romney wins, he's going to, and has a Congress that will go along with him, they're going to unwind healthcare.
And not just that.
It's clear that that's kind of the leading thing. That's a leading thing with them. If you're looking at this a little bit longer term, the next presidential term probably nominates 2 and maybe 3 Supreme Court justices. So those are sort of the long term pieces of it. But I think the main issue, if you reduced this all down to one issue, and maybe the reason, Robert, that the economy hasn't been in front is these guys want that health care plan and these guys don't. And that's sort of, right now, that's kind of the binary. Whether that'll be what we're looking at in late September, early October, when we're actually in the environment where people are voting and making their choices, remains to be seen. But right now, that's what it looks like.
Guantanamo Bay will stay open, no matter which one wins. Should I just comment on how the fact we just don't have a blooper? The whole show was a blooper, really. Just one long, unending blooper.